There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hey, this is Brandy Scott from the Business Breakfast. This is our bite-sized business breakfast, our daily roundup of the best things we've been doing on the show on Wednesday.
Starting with aviation, our top story is that Dubai has kept its title as the busiest international airport. We'll get to that in a second, but first of all, Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airports, has been with us in the studio. And we began with the big story that everybody's talking about. It is, of course, the coronavirus. Paul explained the airport's response.
Well, as I think is usual here in Dubai, we reacted very quickly. We liaised very closely with the Ministry of Health and the GCAA, and we deployed 6 cameras, which cover all of the arrivals from China, to conduct screening. These are thermal imaging cameras to detect any abnormal rise in body temperature, which is quite a good detection of the virus itself. And of course, we heard the news yesterday that flights, apart from Beijing, have now been suspended from all other points in China to the UAE in accordance with the GCAA directive. So hopefully the quarantine measures around the world will help contain what's going on at the moment.
So the real reason he was in the studio was to talk about those figures. And this was the moment, because we didn't have them earlier on in the morning, when Paul revealed whether or not Dubai had managed to hold off Heathrow. Because one of the runways was shut for 6 weeks and passenger numbers fell last year. But this is when he told us whether or not they managed to hold off Heathrow.
Well, very fortunately, we retained our crown very, very vociferously above Heathrow. Not something that I crow about very often, but we actually had a slight drop in 2019 because of those events, the closure of the runway for 45 days, the 737 MAX grounding, and of course the bankruptcy of Jet Airways, which led to a bit of a hiatus in capacity to India. And if you actually took those into consideration, we would have had about 1.3% passenger growth, about 3.2 million passengers we lost because of those three events. So we ended the year at about 86.4 million. The Q4 traffic actually was up to 21.9, which is 1.3% growth. So I think the signs for 2020 are very positive. But the days of double-digit growth, I think, which were the result of traffic rights being available and slots at DXB being plentiful, they're probably over for the time being. But we've got some very exciting plans for the future, which I'll be happy to talk to you about at a later date.
Well, one of the things he did talk to us about was how they responded to the rains that we had in Dubai a few weeks ago, earlier on this year. We know, of course, we all saw the photographs on social media. Many buildings, many properties around Dubai were affected by that, including DXB, the airport.
Well, two things. I mean, first of all, within 36 hours, we had a greater level of rainfall than we saw in the whole of 2019. So to suggest that that was an unusual event, I think, is a bit of an understatement. The other thing, of course, is I looked at the weather radar, and sadly, all the eye of the storms on all occasions was concentrated right above the airport. So we got the brunt of the weather. And of course, it was a pretty overwhelming event, and we had to rush around and get all sorts of mitigations in place. And of course, there's been a huge review of the drainage. We've got extra pumps in, we've reinforced our electricity supplies, we've cleared all the sand out of the drains, because of course, this sort of weather, although it was unprecedented, maybe we should expect that for the future. So we're taking a huge number of different steps to get our infrastructure ready for those sort of weather events.
The full interview with Paul is available as a podcast on our website, DubaiEye1038.com. Right, let's talk transportation, because the RTA is pushing the button on self-driving cars. We heard this week that they have released the rules and regulations for trialing self-driving cars.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because I assumed that the rules around trialing the cars would only be sort of rules for the car company about what you could do and the speeds and the safety and all the rest of it. It's not. It's rules for everybody, including, I think, the RTA, but for police, for ambulance services, for absolutely everybody involved in the entire chain of getting these tests up and running safely.
So we've asked them what lessons have they learned while conducting autonomous trials in Dubai? This is what Ahmed Barizian told us.
Over the last couple of years, we have conducted several trials, namely with shuttle buses in different parts of Dubai, such as Business Bay, Dubai Silicon Oasis, Dubai Sustainability City, etc. We have also done trials with autonomous taxis in Dubai Silicon Oasis. So yes, we have learned a lot of lessons along the way. Some of the most important lessons are that it's very important for people, namely the residents in Dubai, to accept this technology. We feel that when people hop onto these autonomous cars, there is a bit of apprehension initially, and then as they understand the safety features, as they understand the contingency features of these vehicles, they become more and more convinced and more relaxed. So it's very important that people accept the vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and the technologies that run it. We also noticed that there is a high potential for autonomous mobility systems to solve first mile and last mile challenges and integration with public transport systems. The regulation that governs these vehicles must be quite dynamic because the technology is advancing at a very, very rapid pace. And therefore, it's very important for legislation to be generic as well as flexible enough to accommodate different technologies and to accommodate technologies as they evolve. And finally, it's very important that we take into consideration the weather conditions in Dubai. So, for example, the hot weather, the humidity and the dust sometimes, allow the sensors or if you like, reduce the accuracy of sensors, for example. And therefore, it's very important that technologies are able to adapt to the different climate and weather conditions in Dubai. So these are the most important lessons that we have learned in all the trials that we have conducted over the last couple of years with different types of autonomous cars.
Ahmed Barizian of the RTA on driverless cars in Dubai.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are discussing Operation Fox Hunt. Dubai police have arrested a gang of cyber criminals involved in a $1 billion employment scam. We are going to have a look at the ins and outs of that, as well as what you can do to protect yourself. Very pleased to have James Tebbs, forensic advisory partner at the law firm Grant Thornton. James, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Do you want to run us through Operation Fox Hunt?
With pleasure, yes. From what we've seen released to date, so this is an online employment scam involving apparently 9 people. I think what's particularly interesting about this case is its sophistication and complexity. So there were apparently 81 companies set up in 18 countries, which is obviously a complicated network. Social media accounts set up to give the impression of legitimacy of this particular scheme and all designed effectively to defraud victims of the scheme out of money or personal information. So as we understand it at the moment, the gang had already achieved some 32 million dirham. According to the police report, there were a further 1,100 credit card details that had been compromised with an exposure of 64 million further dirham.
So what's the actual mechanic of the scam?
So in essence, what they're trying to do is attract people into new positions. They're looking for victims who are interested in a new job or in a new role. And in some ways, that tips the balance of power in that conversation in favour of the fraudster because they have something which the victim wants. And so, in essence, through what they'll do is they'll post job adverts. They may set up fictitious websites and post adverts on job search sites, which will lead through to the fictitious company websites underneath. And then they'll go through an interview process, often asking for a CV, maybe going as far as the interview itself. And then normally get to the stage of asking either for personal information, which might help the fraudsters with a range of other types of frauds, or simply asking them for credit card details and payments directly. And of course, at that point, the victim will understand there's no real job, the money is gone, or the details have been used for another fraud.
How easy is it to spot something like this? Because this doesn't sound like an email from someone telling me I've just inherited $1 trillion and can I give them my bank account details?
So I think that's a very good question. And I think what I would say on that, first of all, is that to some extent this needs to be destigmatized, right? So if you fall victim to this type of scam, I think there's a natural level of embarrassment that people will feel. But in reality, this type of scam affects anybody, all walks of life. It's not uncommon. And so detecting it, that really depends on the sophistication of the scam. So the usual types of tips and checks, like looking for website details, making sure that the URL address makes sense, making sure that it appears to be a genuine website. If it's a recognizable company, double checking that through other routes are ways that you can detect a scam of this nature. But sophisticated frauds, particularly cyber crimes of this type, and they're becoming increasingly sophisticated, it can be quite difficult, particularly where you're inclined to want what the scammer is offering, and therefore perhaps your guard is down and you'll trust them a little bit more.
Because emotions would be running high. You've been out of work, possibly, or this is a better opportunity than you've got. You want to believe it's real.
Absolutely. And that's why the balance of power, I think, tips perhaps, you know, people who would be naturally cautious, perfectly sensible, will understand things like, you know, risk around their internet banking and so on and so forth, might still be inclined to give away more than they would like because they believe that there is something for them to get. And the fraudster will play on that with the intention of getting them to divulge more information than they realise.
You said stigma earlier. How much of this kind of stuff goes unreported because people are embarrassed?
No, I think that's also a very good question. And the reality is trying to find statistics around this type of fraud and other types of similar scams is very difficult. Largely for that reason, actually. But it is not uncommon at all. In fact, you know, topically, the FBI have released something on this only about 10 days ago, highlighting the risk of hiring scams. So it's not uncommon. In terms of how prevalent it is, it's difficult to tell. Back to that stigma, I think people would have a natural inclination to withdraw a bit, perhaps not report the fact that they've been a victim. And so that makes it difficult to detect. But that ultimately is what we have to get over so that the police can take the type of action they have done.
These guys have raised 32 million dirhams with this fraud, some $8 million. How much would individual people have been being taken for? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, do you get done for $100 or does it just keep going?
That's a good question. I think also difficult to give precise statistics on that. In reality, what we're talking about is likely to be a very large number of smaller instances. So that 32 million is made up of lots of, I would guess, lots of smaller numbers. The FBI gave a figure of $3,000 was the average loss that people had suffered. Obviously, that's a bit US-centric, but perhaps gives a type of indication. So it's going to be for fees like visa processing, maybe travel and accommodation, you know, perhaps legal verification of documentation, that type of thing. So not huge numbers necessarily, but potentially in large volume.
Do you see, as a legal forensics expert, these kind of things on the rise, both in terms of number and in level of sophistication?
Yes, to some degree. I think this is actually kind of old tricks with new tools, if for want of a better phrase. You know, so that the constant developments in technology mean that there are new and more sophisticated ways of trying to scam people. But I think the underlying scheme, unfortunately, is a human one. You know, the sort of human nature of potentially trying to take advantage of others. Unfortunately, there are aspects of society that will do that. So I don't necessarily see that fraud and cybercrime of this type, these types of scams, is necessarily on the rise, but the tools do facilitate it. The other point I'd raise on that is, I mentioned that detection and so on maybe is lower than it might be because of reported cases. I do think there's a growing sophistication in terms of people being able to spot this, and that's both at an individual level and at a corporate level. And to some extent, when you see various survey statistics, particularly around the region, that would appear to show that the numbers are growing. But I think in reality, what's happening is that people are better at spotting it.
And I do that. Give me the three tips before we let you go. What do I need to watch for? Red flags.
Well, so look, from an individual perspective, I think, you know, it's apply caution, right? First of all, destigmatize it. Understand that this can happen to you and it may well. So verify the people that you're talking to. Make sure that you check, if you've gone through an online website, that the person you're dealing with is genuinely a representative of the company they appear to be from, and you can go through other sources to do that. Anybody that's a legitimate provider is going to be quite happy to verify and validate their own identity. And I think on top of that, take reasonable precautions, right? Do not give out personal information. Do not make payments without certainty. Those are the general rules that people will be familiar with for personal finance management anyway.
James Tibbs, forensic advisory partner at the law firm Grant Thornton. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
My mover and shaker this morning is Kareem. I guess I'm asking how much they can move and shake, although hopefully not your possessions. We spoke to the guys at Kareem recently about whether or not they were developing one app to rule them all. we had Basil Al-Naloui, the managing director of Careem, in the studio to talk about how far, because they've spoken, haven't they, about wanting to Careem to be a
super app.
A super app. And we said, how far can that go? This is what Basil told us.
So in a year's time, that's a good time. That's a long time in Careem, the world. But, like you said, you'll continue to see food, you'll see delivery, you'll see payments much more, which means that you can top up your mobiles, which you can do today, actually. You can send payments outside and so on. But the exciting part is that, these are three verticals we want to do on our own. The payments, the ride hailing, the food, the deliveries is stuff we want to do ourselves. But in a year's time, hopefully, we'll start onboarding global players who provide other services. And to your question, it's going to differ from city to city. Because in Dubai, maybe my customers want travel services and they want, laundry services. So then we're hoping to onboard people or companies that do travel and laundry and so on. So per city, we'll look at what customers want, where they want their convenience in, what offline services they want to move them digitally and provide that service through partnerships. I'd like to say, think of us, we used to be a store in a mall that provides ride hailing services. Today, we are building a mall and we provide three of these stores, and then we want to provide space for other services to be in our mall.
And more services are here because Careem is rejigging Careem Box.
This is Order Anything is what you're talking about, isn't it?
I am. I'm talking about Order Anything, the souped up Careem Box. Careem Box was, if it's in the box, we'll bring it to you.
This is the Careem Box with Go Faster stripes,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Alloy wheels.
Exactly. So as long as it doesn't weigh over 7 kg and as long as it fits in this 32x32x32 box, you can have it. Children, pumpkins, small pets. Whatever it happens to
be. It's a bold claim, Order Anything, isn't it?
But they are refining the offering, and I just couldn't help thinking of this super app idea that we had been discussing when I was looking at this in the early hours of this morning. It's now got two distinct functions through the Careem app, Order Anything. One is pick up and drop, where they will go and pick up something. Richard's left his lunch at home. That's fine. Careem goes, gets it, brings it to the studio and drops it off for you.
Malcolm Taylor's notes, they would have made a fortune out of him. He was always leaving his notes at home. He'd get to the studio about 5:30. He'd be like, I've lost my notes. He'd have to wake up Teresa and she'd drive them in here. But
exactly.
Now we've got an app for that.
We have an app for that. Also, Shop and Drop, where as long as whatever you're buying is under 350 dirhams, the captains, so the drivers, will go and buy it for you and bring it to you.
That I quite like.
So do I. I just wish there wasn't a 350 cap on it, but yes, I do.
There's probably no bad thing there's a 350 dirham cap on it. But this is interesting because it's e-commerce, but not as we know it. Because if you look at the two big players here, Noon and Amazon.ae, there are others as well, the niche players. So much of what they're doing is a prime type service where you don't pay for delivery. I ordered a pair of scissors the other day, 17 dirham pair of scissors, didn't pay for delivery, turned up the next day before lunchtime. No one's making money out of that. Clearly that's heavily, heavily subsidized. Careem though wants Brandy to pay for her 17 dirham pair of scissors.
They do, but they've actually what Careem wants is for Brandy to just get into the habit of turning to Careem for more and more and more stuff during the day.
So it's getting you into the quote-unquote ecosystem.
Yeah, and you can communicate with the driver, you can let them know what you want to be purchased. I mean, I don't know if you're going back and forward in terms of, they don't have the chicken, they've only got the tuna. Oh, yes. They've got the tuna, I want it with cucumber. I mean, I'm not sure how in-depth these conversations are actually going to go.
In fact, I'm looking at, our housekeeper yesterday was in a supermarket while picking the kids up, and I'm looking at the email back and forth that we've got. Morning, Grace. Do you want what salami do you want? Do you want this one? Photograph. This one or this one? The Napoli or the Milano?
Yeah.
Just the one in the photo.
If these guys are doing a spinnies shop, maximum 7 kilograms, this could get all out of hand, couldn't it?
But I get what they're doing. And it's going to cost the price of a Careem ride, so I guess. They'll go to a supermarket pretty close by. My guess is you're going to be talking 30-ish, 40-ish, maybe 50 dirhams. For the privilege?
But useful. But absolutely useful. Yeah. There's a book that I need for a session I'm doing this afternoon. I could absolutely phone someone, get them to pop into a bookshop, buy it for me and bring it to me and save me quite a bit of time.
Because this is for the exceptional items. This is not for your everyday, because your Kareem bill would rapidly get out of control. But it's for that once every 2 or 3 months where you need something, either for work or you just, you know, you're really, really, oh no, it's a birthday present for an important birthday. It's those emergency things. And for 30, 40, 50 dirhams, if they solve that problem, good luck to them. I've got two newsmakers this morning. Both of them are American politicians. One of them is the current president of the United States,
who is currently giving the State of the Union as we speak.
I'm looking at the live streaming of what he's done. There's not a huge amount, to be honest, that jumps out. He has got bipartisan standing ovation, which is not something you normally associate with Donald Trump. But that's to do with the reforms of the criminal justice system. Even Nancy Pelosi gave him a round of applause for that. He has declined to shake the hand of Nancy Pelosi, his political opponent, and he is telling everyone how great the economy is under his presidency, which, to be fair, it is in pretty good shape. But no real fireworks yet in the State of the Union. But he's not my big newsmaker today. My big newsmaker today is this guy.
So we don't know all the results, but we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation. By all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
Who's that?
That is Pete.
It is Pete. Blah, 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 blah. It's the Democratic candidate. This is the Iowa caucus, which has been a complete omni-shambles because the app for counting the votes hasn't worked. But now the results are trickling through, and it looks like Pete Buttigieg, the 38-year-old, is going to be victorious in that, or at least he's going to have the most votes in that. They're talking about 26-ish, 27% of those, which raises all kinds of questions because, I mean, he's been a mayor of a small town. He's 38 years old. He hasn't got a strong track record. I mean, if he's up against like Joe Biden and
I'm watching
like
the
that.
Man giving the State of the Union. And what are you talking about political track records?
You make a very, very valid point. But he seems to be the front runner at the moment. The question is not, does he have the credentials to be the leader of the free world? The question is, how do you pronounce his name? How do you pronounce his name?
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg. That's wrong. But help is at hand. Rachel Smith. Rachel's English is a blog for pronouncing words in American English. She's got 70 million views on YouTube, 2.5 million followers. She's a big deal. And this is her on how to pronounce Pete Buttigieg, the leading candidate at the moment to be the Democratic frontrunner for the presidency.
Well, let's listen to how he says it.
Buttigieg.
So it's not
Pete Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg.
It all boils down to the vowels.
Buttigieg.
So that's how he says his own last name, but it sounds like he's pretty understanding about people just calling him Pete.
Call me Mayor Pete.
That's how he's known.
So have we cleared that up? Pete Buttigieg. The G's are soft, jidge at the end. At the beginning, it's kind of like butter. So it's Buttigieg.
I've only just learnt how to pronounce Kristalina Georgieva.
That took a while, didn't it?
It did. My track record for these things are not great. I think with Pete Buttigieg, the answer is just to say it really quickly because he does.
Or as they suggested at the end of that piece, Pete.
Yes, Pete B. Pete B.
Pete B. Well, POTUS 46, as he would hope to be this time next year, giving the State of the Union speech, which Donald Trump is giving right now.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
And a couple of weeks ago on the Business Breakfast, we ran a wildly popular competition. We were giving away a coaching session with a woman who is, and I'm going to say this because she wouldn't, responsible for making Joe Wicks the body coach who he is today. This isn't just any executive or life coach. She is a Sunday Times best-selling author. She is the CEO of the Coaching Academy. She is the woman who's taken entrepreneurs like body coach Joe Wicks from a personal trainer who made $5,000 a month to a global phenomena. Her client lists include more than one Olympic rower, Ben Hunt Davis, gold medal winner, Olympic champion, Dame Kelly Holmes. And we were lucky enough to be able to give away a one-on-one session with her on the sidelines of the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature. We were inundated with entries. And what we asked you to do is we asked you to tell us the killer question that you would ask Bev James if you won this session. Seema actually won the competition, and this is Seema with her killer question.
The question that won me this amazing prize is, we're a small family-run business with a highly experienced older generation heading production and a very talented younger generation heading the office. Both are invaluable to our business, but at constant loggerheads with each other regarding their ideas in the projects we do.
And there you go. Seema having a very Dubai family business question. What do you do with the younger generation and the older generation when they just can't see eye to eye? Seema, unsurprisingly, is very excited about her coaching session this weekend.
A big thank you to Dubai Eye for providing me with this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It still hasn't fully sunk in that in just a few days I will actually be face-to-face with Bev. I'm very excited and also quite nervous. There is so much that I will take away from this meeting, and to be guided by this extraordinary person with so much experience is something I will never forget. Thank you, Dubai Eye. I'm so excited in finally taking my business to the next level.
We're excited too because Bev is in the studio with us right now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we want to find out this morning what makes you tick. What makes you the person who can get the best out of people like Dame Kelly Holmes, Joe Wicks, Ben Hunt Davis? What makes a good coach?
Gosh, it's a bit difficult when you're actually pointing the finger at yourself, isn't it? I'm used to looking at other people. I think to be a good coach, it's about really immersing yourself in your profession. So when I started out as a coach, I would coach anyone, anyone with a pulse. You know, it would literally be if I had an opportunity, I would seek to coach someone. So I think to start with, you need to immerse yourself in your profession and coach as many people as possible. Now, that is just on a broad scale, and that gives you lots of experience. But ultimately, I think you also need to niche. And my niche really is working with people that want to be seen, sought after, successful, build a brand, and build a business. So that's where I've chosen to focus my time and energy. And that also links to my background as well.
But what's the secret sauce? If we take someone like Joe Wicks, who we've had on this show, he calls meeting you one of the most pivotal moments in his career. What were you able to do for him that he couldn't do on his own?
I think, again, it comes back to potential. So I think if I was going to say I do have a secret power, I think I can actually see through and I can spot someone's potential long before they can. And once I see that potential, all of a sudden it will roll out like a red carpet and it'll go boom, 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 boom. Okay, I can see exactly where this person could go. However, as a coach, it's not my job to tell them where they need to go. That needs to come from them. So it's drawing out what they could potentially do to take their career to the next level.
But the people who credit you for what they've done for their careers, they speak very commercially. They speak in percentages. Mm. They speak in money terms. I tend to think of coaching as being very emotional. But we're talking here about, you know, multiplying factors, revenues and profits. How important is that?
I think it is important. So, I mean, I never start off to, you know, make lots of money. And my clients never start off to make lots of money. Job most certainly didn't. We start off with just how can we make a difference? And if you're helping people solve a problem and you can make a difference in the world, the money will come. So the money is never what we aim for in the beginning. If someone came to me and said, can you make me a millionaire? Really not interested. If someone's already a millionaire, they'll make more money. I'm really not interested. I need to know what difference do you want to make in the world, and I will help them make a difference, and then the money will come.
Have you ever turned clients away?
All the time. All the time. I hide from people. I mean, the website, I don't even have a website for my management business. I work with some incredible people now. Henry and Ian from Bosch, who I'm here with at the festival. Some really incredible people. But 99% of the time, I do have to say no, because I like to focus on a small group of people. And I stay with them for a number of years.
How do you choose the people you do focus on? What makes them different?
They have to have a mission. They have to be purpose-driven, mission-led. So, for example, with Henry and Ian, they're vegans. They want to put more plants on plates. I totally get that. I'm not vegan. See, since meeting them, I actually haven't eaten meat for quite a while. But again, we've worked together now for just over a year, and their income has literally trebled in that time, which we found out last week. So it does come, but it's about doing the right things, knowing what your values are and knowing what the vision is for the world and the difference you want to make in the world.
But what is the secret to doing that? If Rich and I sat in front of you and said, all right, then make us more successful, what kind of things do you look at? What kind of things do you get people doing?
I would, first of all, want to know what success meant to you, because what it means to each of you could be different. What it means to me could be different. So if you say, makes me more successful in what area of your life? Because we've all got different areas of your life. Is it this current job? Is it, you know, as an author? What particular bit would you want to be more successful in? And then for me, to get me excited, it would be, what difference will that make in the world to other people?
Talk to us about your book, which is a Sunday Times bestseller, Do It or Ditch It. Is there another one to come? Is it going to follow?
Do you know, I keep telling myself I actually need to do another book. I don't know. You know, it's still a great book because that book was written over 10 years ago. And on the aeroplane over, I thought, I'd just sort of look through it again. You don't go back and read your own book. And there's just some great things in there. So I don't know. In order to do another book, I'll have to know that I can actually top that one because it has been successful. And I'm really pleased with the content in the book. It does make a difference to people.
Let's talk about that content. And let's talk about the questions that we should be asking ourselves before we have to let you go. Ben Hunt Davis, the Olympic gold medal winner, says that the thing you do for him is you ask him difficult questions. You hold him to account. Mm. What kind of questions should we be asking ourselves on a daily basis?
I think we need to ask ourselves some basic ones, which is, what do you need to do more of? What do you need to do less of? What do you need to stop doing? What do you need to start doing? So, and also, if you're not doing something, I guess the biggest question is, what potential do you feel you're living up to in your life? What percentage? If you had to say, okay, I know inside I can do more, but what percentage of my potential am I fulfilling? If that's 60%, what would get you to 70%? Is there some fear holding you back? Is there a limiting belief holding you back? And that's what I think I can help people to blitz through.
Thank you very much for joining us today. If you want to hear more from Bev, she will be speaking at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature Saturday at 1 o'clock. That's the session. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Bev James.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.